You're in your first year of sobriety, it's a great event.
Wow.
Really an honor to be here. It's a great thrill for me. I get to participate in the attitude adjustment meeting at 8:15. Come on down and share. Let us know who you are. You know, get up and share what's going on with you. Take the third and seventh step. And it's a wonderful tradition. And it's a wonderful meeting. And it means a lot to me. My wife and I were supposed to be on the trip last year. We got about halfway down, and we got a phone call that Nancy's mom had taken a turn and was starting to move on. And we missed the trip, but we didn't miss the journey. We got to be with her and hold her and sing to her while she took the light into another room. And today's the anniversary of that. And it's an incredible thing to me. This family. Years ago, I made a mistake. I used to steal from people who wouldn't complain a lot, usually. I had a pretty good picker, and I blew it with this guy. He was uppity about being ripped off. And I did some work that I didn't get paid for. I had him advance me. I took that check. I told him I'd get the check when I got the check, but I got that check and I spent that check, too. And he, instead of just kind of rolling over on it, he copied those checks, wrote a letter about exactly what I had done, and sent it to every member of my family to get a hold of anyone who I worked for or had ever worked for. Don't be so grateful. I was in my father and mother-in-law's house when my father-in-law got the letter, and I watched him read it and saw his heart fall out. And the difference between that and a year ago, and the year that we've spent mourning and being together and holding on to each other and walking through this thing, it's just not possible. I'm a man who at the age of 21, the night my father died, showed up at the hospital loaded on heroin and couldn't give him a kiss and give him a hug and watch him take his life into another room. And that was a horror and a terror in my life that was never going to go away. And I today have an extraordinary relationship with my father. I've made those amends. My sons know about their grandpa. They've heard funny stories about him. And it took me years to even put a picture of him up in our house. And that's our family. And you're our family. And this is the connective tissue that, because of it, my alcoholism has been going above the horizon for 21 years. I haven't had a drink for 21 years. And I couldn't stay sober for 15 minutes. My alcoholism will go below the horizon, stop presenting itself as a real piece of business, and I would act without sense, without reason, and I would drink again. And nothing to keep it up there as a real piece of business. It would be a complaint. And we'd go below the horizon, stop being a real piece of business, and the terror would begin again. I had a really extraordinary experience some months ago. This buddy of mine, I love newcomer clinics. They're just, I love them. And he was working with a new guy, and guy had got a couple of weeks of riding and saw this bruise on the guy's chest. And he said, "What happened?" The guy said, "He opened his shirt and he had these huge purple bruises all over his torso." And my friend said, "What?" And the guy said, "Well, a couple of weeks ago when I hit my bottom, I drank a bottle of vodka and I decided to take myself out. So I stole a vial of nitroglycerin tablets from a heart patient. And he swallowed all the nitroglycerin and then started slamming his body into the wall, trying to blow himself up." His nickname isn't like Boom Boom or Night Trucker, and Boom Boom Group sucks. If you're new here, you're going to hear some wacky stuff about alcoholism. Some general statements about alcoholism. Some of it makes sense to me and some of it doesn't. The stuff that doesn't make sense to me, I've never found in the Big Book of AA. I've heard that alcoholics don't like change. Just don't like it. Don't like change of anything. And I don't like change. I don't like
it. Yeah.
I really like change. I like it. I've never heard anyone get to a podium and say, "I hit the lottery, I'm having sex with identical twins, it's killing me."
about trying to help his son, and I made a phone call and didn't get a return. And he called me again. It's much worse now. He's living in a car. So I call him, and I get this message. Now, I know that he's living in a car, and the car's broken. And on the message, the Marvin Gaye song, Let's Get It On. Years ago, me and a couple of guys were checking this guy in the Radiate Hospital, which in California, it's just a bad place. It's not a place you want to... It's not the premium treatment. It's a tough place. And the guy was going in, he had a ribbon of drool swinging from his chin, and a woman walked in with another guy, and this guy was with looked up and said, "Hey, baby. Hey, baby, what are you doing with that new guy? Come on down here." So I called the dad back to tell him that I had talked to his son, and he wanted to know what we had talked about, and I couldn't tell him because I can't trust. And I heard that horrible sound in the father's voice. His son is on the street living in a broken car, and I felt like like his son was kidnapped, and I couldn't tell him if he was dead or alive. And he kept saying, "But what? Are you going to talk to him? Is he going to be?" And I just kept saying, I don't know. I don't know. And I just heard this guy's blood run cold. I didn't know what I was doing when I was doing it. I didn't know the amount of harm I was creating. If I had, I don't think I could have hit the pain in my head. You know, and now I don't know all the good stuff I'm doing. I'm doing stuff good that I didn't know that I'm doing. I had a friend named Howard who came off the nickel in L.A. He came off Skid Row and got sober and stayed sober until the day he died, which is a pretty big deal. He had been thrown out of the Salvation Army, which is sort of a great badge of courage. And he was a couple years sober and went down to do a 12-step call in a feedback hotel down in Skid Row in L.A. And he and this other guy tried to 12-step this guy Sullivan. And this guy was in bed, they were talking over him, and this guy Sullivan subsequently drank himself to death. And about 10 years later, Howard was at a meeting, and a guy pulled him aside and said, "You know, you saved my life." And Howard said, "I don't know." And the guy said, "Look, you remember this guy Sullivan?" And Howard said, "Yeah." And the guy said, "I don't know what to do. I'm talking right into the mic, so I don't quite know what to do. Maybe we need to turn the mic up." Can people hear it in the back? Or? No? Pardon me? Okay, I don't know what to do. I can't kind of yell and I can't do that. This feels like I'm on acid. But I'll continue because I'm used to it. In his last couple of years, he was pulling out, he was driving to Las Vegas and pulled out at night to drive through the desert. He was out for a couple of minutes in this cop car. Pulled him over, he went, "Oh, God." And the cop walked up to the car and said, "Are you a friend of Bill's?" And Howard said, "Yeah, why?" And the cop said, "Well, I saw your bumper sticker and I'm a member of the fellowship and I like to start my night out with some fellowship, so I just want to..." Favorite newcomer stories. He used to tell this story about an old timer and a new guy who got a 12-step call. They went out in the country driving out on this dirt road and they pull up to a lean-to that has a burlap bag for a door and they walk in and there's a drunk, dirty underwear sitting on a stained mattress with a candle flickering and a can and sucking on a bottle of wine. And the new guy looks at the drunk and says, "Look, I'm new. I don't know a lot about this, but I do know this. If you keep drinking, you're going to lose all this." By the way, it's fun watching the newcomers try to relax. It's just fun. I'm going to shimmer for a while like a penny in a frying pan. To a very troubled family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him, and my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose wore her wig backwards. They're just really very troubled and very crazy. And there was mental and physical abuse and chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts. And if you knew, all I've got is good news for you, because my family had nothing to do with making me an alcoholic. I have a weird physical reaction to alcohol. I can't control and moderate if you're a special and a drug addict or just a drug addict. Welcome to AA. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Any crack monsters out there, or tweakers, like welcome all the tweakers. Glad you're here. If you've ever licked all the features off your own face, I'm glad you're here. I'm not making fun of you. You can come in close, but I don't care what you got. You can be like the big-footed dope addict, the dope Goliath. You can be the Energizer bunny of crackheads. It doesn't matter to me. Just catch alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. The infection, my sponsor used to say, enters through the ear and infects you and then start infecting other people. And if it was just a mental problem, I would be in really good shape. I mean, I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand. And I've had no beef with therapy. Therapy's great stuff. I'm in therapy now. I have no beef at all with therapy. I love therapy. My colossal blunder is I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy. I mean, the idea of therapy, millions of people use it, and it works. If you've got anxiety, if you're neurotic, if you have a neurosis, which is you have anxiety, then you have a terrible resolution for it. You have a bad solution to your problem. Your solution is worse than your problem, and it's a neurosis. So with conventional therapy, you pre-associate, you delve into your past, you do some stuff, and you would find a better resolution for the anxiety. That's the idea, but I have alcoholism. So I go to therapy, I feel like I feel terrible. Why? Well, I was too drunk to walk today, so I drove. Well, what are we going to do about that? Let's talk about it. Let me ask you a question. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. I feel terrible. Why? Well, yesterday I sharpened a hypodermic needle on the back of a matchbook striker and sucked some heroin up through a plugged up cigarette filter and injected it. I feel miserable. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. And I'm telling the truth. Nothing. I don't know what happened. My brain got too big for my skull, my mouth filled with saliva, the room spun, I went out for cigarettes, and I wound up in Baltimore. I have no idea what happened, and I'm telling them the truth. It would take a panel of therapists 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just to put my stuff in a file and put it on a shelf, let alone treat it. My alcoholism is so industrious, so creative in producing pathology, insanity, bad relationships, broken dreams, broken hearts, broken promises. It's impossible to stack anything up against it. Impossible. That's why a lot of people say, well, you have to stop drinking, you've got too much money. Oh, good. Let's go down to Skid Row and take away all their money, and they'll stop drinking. I used to sponsor a guy who was a beautiful guy, who was a very powerful, very wealthy guy, and he couldn't get sober. He just couldn't get it. He even, at one point, was sequestered on the private island of a friend, and he didn't drink until he got off the island. And he used to call me and say, I got it. And it would be a new thing. I got it. So he calls me one day and says, I got it. What? I come over to his house, and he's got, there's about 100 or something like that of original big books with the cover. There's about 100 of them still kind of collector's items. And he had bought one for about 15 grand. And he said, I got it. So I opened it up, and I'm looking at it, and it's a touched. I said, it looks like it's never been touched. He said, yeah. I said, oh, so you got the loser book. Loser book. It's been handed down from loser to loser. 65 years. So loud on his head that he tied his neck to a faucet on the side of the wall and sat down until he was dead. He just couldn't bear it anymore. If my problem was just physical, I'd be in a lot better shape. There are great physical treatments. There's great ways to get healthy. If my problem was just mental, there's great therapists. My problem is much, much worse than that. I started a drink and I couldn't. And I had this bizarre thinking that kept talking me into taking a drink I couldn't stop taking, and I developed this cancer of the soul, this shadow on my heart, this tapeworm, this spiritual tapeworm that ate me up from the inside and left me hollow and insane and alone. And I didn't even know what was happening. I dropped out of school. I was on the streets of New York for 2.5 years, 14 to 17. I got kind of paroled into a special school that I loved. I graduated valedictorian on the brink of going to jail for being arrested. I sold heroin to a New York City cop. I think I had been watching Starsky and Hutch or something, and I got the idea in my head that if you ask the cop, if you ask someone if they were a cop, and they said no, and they were, that it was entrapment. So I'm in the car, I'm being taken away, and I said, you know what, I asked you, if you were a cop, and you said, no, this is entrapment. You lied to me. And the policeman looked at me and said, I'm supposed to lie to you, you moron. You're a criminal. And I don't know if anybody here has ever been to the Bronx County Courthouse, but it was designed by a Vincent Price. It's just, it's horrible. It's a big gothic. It's really terrifying. And when you go in, I was on a chain with 25 of my closest friends and relatives. And this woman, they used to let this street woman in every, well, when I was there, and she would cross herself as you walk by and say, God bless y'all, y'all going to the electric kid this morning. It was like theater in a show for the cops. She was there. And, I was in my early 20s, I was in a cycle of using intravenous drugs. I was hitchhiking down from the Bronx to Manhattan, and I got picked up by my aunt and uncle. My father had a massive stroke, and I went to the hospital, and I wasn't there. I couldn't show up for him. I felt like a pig, like an animal. And I had to do something really quick, because I couldn't be that guy. I couldn't be the guy, that guy. And I figured out real quick it was needles and heroin, and all I had to do was never do that again, and I wouldn't be that guy. And I did it, not for 13 years. Shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play, and a new usherette with long brown hair walked in, and I took one look at her. I didn't talk to her, I didn't say hello. I walked back to the dressing room, got up on a chair, and announced to the guys in this dressing room that if anyone talked with the new usherette with brown hair, I'd break all the bones in their hands and feet. And we've been married 30 years. So. And we had a great time. We had a great time. We were in our early 20s, living in New York. I was acting on Broadway, dancing a very exciting job, and we were having a great time. One of the most misquoted lines in the Big Book of AA for me. I've heard people say that their worst day in here is better than their best day out there. No. No. I had a great time out there. I really did. I had a great time out there. What the guy says at the end of chapter 3 is I wouldn't trade my worst day in here for my best day out there, because I won't trade this way of life. I won't take a nickel when I could have a quarter. I won't live like a loser anymore, and I understand. But we had a great time. We had our son Micah, our beautiful son Micah, and he was really welcomed into our community. We were surrounded by friends and phone calls and a lot of love. And in 2 years and 9 months, we became completely isolated when our son Jesse was born, no one even showed up at the hospital. There were no flowers, no phone calls. It hurt too much to be around us. We were radioactive. And that night, Jesse was sick. He was up in an incubator. Max was all alone in the room. The phone went ringing. A doctor called me and said, "Where are you? Your family's in trouble. Why aren't you here?" I said, "You know what? I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son. I can't do it." And this doctor offered me to take my kid to her house. I didn't even know this doctor. And her husband will watch our son while I came down. And I said, "No." I had no way to accept this woman's generosity. It was the terrible night our son was born, in our terrible days. And little were we to know that it was going to get worse. It was going to get way worse. It was going to get 3 years worse. And at the end of the 3 years, the boys were just broken. Nancy and I were just in a suicide pact. It wasn't even a marriage anymore. And so, you know, I don't know if that's the bottom. It was bad. It was really hard. We had become completely insane. We had become so insane that a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. "You sold my car." That's house sitting for someone, and they come back and you're in escrow. And you're showing the house. The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. And on April 22nd, 1985, I crossed the line. I swear I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm. And why I didn't make it okay to do that, I couldn't tell you. I have no idea. It's a mystery to me. I called my therapist of record in my 18th year of psychotherapy, my first Jungian therapist. I told him what I had done, and he said to me, I didn't know this at the time, but he said to me pretty much exactly what Carl Jung told the 12-step Bill Wilson. Jung told this American millionaire who he had psychoanalyzed and then had a drink. Jung said to him, "There's nothing that can be done for you. There's nothing. I can't help you. All you can do, we can do is institutionalize you, or you hire a bodyguard." And they conversed more, and Jung said, there's been times when alcoholics of your description have had spiritual experiences. And the guy said, "Well, I'm a member of the church." And Jung said, that's wonderful. But I'm talking about a displacement. I'm talking about a deflation and a spiritual displacement where, in essence, he said, where your roots actually grasp new soil. And that morning, my therapist said, "I can't help you." And I said, "What?" He said, "There's nothing that can be, the only thing we can do is institutionalize you." And then he said the thing Carl Jung couldn't say. "Or you intend the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous." A couple of weeks before I go step sober, my 6 and 3-year-old son were at the dinner table. I reached for something, and when my hand came near my head, he went like this. And he went like that. It was a knee-jerk reaction, and he recoiled from me. And I didn't even know how that had happened. I was so repulsive to the 6-year-old kid, so frightening. So a couple of months before that, I was hung over in the morning. I'm with my perfect baby boy, and I got sick in front of him. And he got sick when he saw me get sick. And he didn't have the flu. He didn't eat bad food. He was with his father. If you get in between me and the drink, you disappear. If you're my wife, my lover, my buddy, my bride, my dreams, my aspirations, my children, you vanish. You become gossamer. You float away, or you become something less than human. You disappear, or you become paper mache. And how much disappearing can a baby bear before they start feeling transparent? And what happens, my experience in my own home and in the homes of many, many people I've been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to work with, the children either tend to become pointlessly aggressive, en route to a goal that never takes place, or they just throw in the towel and say, "What's the use anyway?" It's right there in the second and third chapter. They're describing us and they're describing friends and family. And I didn't know it. If I had known how bad it was, I don't think I could have fit it in my head. It was really awful. And why I went to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I couldn't tell you. I absolutely did not tell you. One other thing that had happened a couple of months before I got sober, right? Michael was six at the time. He asked me if there was anything such as God. And I looked into the eyes of a baby and said, no. I said, no. It's crazy. It's insane. I mean, I not only lied to him, I not only stood in the presence of all of this poetry, of all of this order, and said it doesn't exist, but I basically said to a little boy, you know when you can't sleep and it's dark at night and you can't fall asleep? Tough, because that's all there is. That's really what I said. He should have been taken away from me. And on April 22nd, 1985, when that doctor said that to me, I went to the AA meeting and I can't tell you why. It's a mystery to me. On most other days, I would have gladly chosen the institution. I'm a guy who gets excited about dental surgery. You know, it's an uninterrupted source of narcotics for a period of time. Normal people don't get excited about dental surgery. And I still have that kind of thinking. I'm 21 years in, and untreated, I will be there in 2 seconds. 2 years ago, 19 years sober, I had to get a biopsy. And the doctor said, we're going to put about a 6-inch needle into your side and take this tissue. And I went, what? And he said, well, don't worry, we'll relax you. I said, good, and I talked to my sponsor, and I got relaxing okay, and so it was an outpatient thing. I went to the hospital, and the lady checked me in, and I said, do you have a note? You know, I'm supposed to get relaxed. So they do it in there. So I go in there, and somebody comes in to take my clothes, and I said, are you the relaxing guy? They said, no, hold me here. So a guy comes in, he puts a line in my arm, and I figure there's a real opportunity. I said, do you relax me? He said, no, they do it downstairs. So they take me downstairs, and they put me on a table and said, move this way. And I said, I'm not moving anywhere. I was told I was going to get relaxed. I'm not relaxed. I'm not relaxed at all. I promise relaxation. We're in a very early morning here if I'm not relaxed. So a lot of eye rolling, and the wind got the doctor. And the doctor comes in and says, I can't give you anything. When I have that needle in you, you have to respond, or I can nick a vital organ. I said, 11 people have told me I'm going to get relaxed. He said, well, I'll tell you why. I said, why? He said, because you look insane. None of them have been willing to say no to you. And I walked into this room, and I took a look around, and I said, oh my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined. Alcoholics Anonymous. And the room looked to me like it was the product of hundreds of years of inbreeding. There were identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet. Information guy, he got me at the end of the meeting. He's wearing a belt buckle, large. And I'm pretty sure, I think it's because I was out of plans. And if you're new here, I pray to you that you're out of plans. If you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a few. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. My favorite newcomer plan. Make one more guilt deal to set myself up financially for sobriety. And I kept coming back because I guess I was out of plans. But it is a mystery to me. And I stayed sober for 6 months. My wife reached out to the MLM family groups and got her adorable, extraordinary sponsor, Ruby, who she still has. And we were invited to their home, and I felt like I had no skin on. The house was full of love, people bringing food over and hanging out and doing the deal. I just thought, we're just too broken. It's just, I'm really happy for that, but there's just no way this is going to happen for us. And I was 6 months sober, and I knew I was going to drink, because I had seen the AA drill hundreds of times. I knew I was going to drink. My sons had become less frightened of me. My wife and I were talking, and she had the sponsor, and I asked a guy to sponsor me. I consider myself very fortunate to have not drunk it during that six-year period. At that time, there were some old-timers in my home group who were, you know, the you're an idiot, you're a moron, if your lips are moving, you're lying, there was this sort of understanding that they were, it was okay for them to do that because they had been around for a long time, they were very smart, and, I was really repelled by it, and I have remained repelled by it for 21 years. It's just not something that I'm interested in, and that's not an indictment of people who thrive in that situation. I know there are people who are, and I'm just sharing my story. And my story is, I had to get away from that. I had to really navigate my way away from that. And I asked the guy to sponsor me, who said that he pointed out in step three, it says the first thing I have to do is quit playing God. And he just walked towards God with me. You know, he worked the first three steps with me, showed me how to do an inventory. I went back and I read it to him at 9 months of sobriety. I did 6 to 7 for the first time. I wrote up my 8-step list. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know what I was going to do about my sons or my wife or my cop. I didn't know. I couldn't sit down with my sons and apologize. We were little boys. It would have been another self-centered, frothy, emotional, awful thing. My sons have received 21 appropriate birthday gifts on the day of their birthday that they wanted. You know, not once in 21 years have they received the day after radioactive guilt gift. You know, the only place that would take a hot check from me. Here's some drywall, boys. Kids are loving the drywall right now. And my sponsor said, look, I don't know what you're going to do with that stuff. I have no idea. Why don't you do your job at AA? Do your job at AA. And they were going on panels. They were showing up, going to Skid Row, taking commitments to the home group. And he was suggesting to me something that was very, very difficult. That I was supposed to take seemingly disconnected and unrelated actions that were supposed to impact the thing that was troubling me. If you ask me, do I have to worry about that? I want that. What do you want? I'd like to be a good writer. I'd like to have some money. I'd like to have a great romance in my marriage. Okay, you can have those things. Let me ask you something. Do you have to be miserable until you get them? Yeah. I think I crave those things. I mean, if I'm not miserable about them, who the hell's going to be miserable? They're going to go away. So if I say that, then I'm in fact saying to you that my misery purchases the thing that I desire. And if that doesn't become an entrenched position for me, they'll never manifest. It'll never happen. What a design for living. It's great. I was a couple of years sober, and I was making our son's lunch, and I asked, Michael was 8, and I said, what do you want for hot dog? He said, I want mustard, onions, and lettuce. I said, lettuce? He said, okay, I want lettuce. And he walked away, and came back about 45 minutes later, and looked at me directly in the eye, and I'm not altering one syllable. He said, I will never again allow your opinion of what I want affect what I ask for. So I asked him to sponsor me. Jesse broke his wrist. This is a couple of years later. Mike was 10. And he's a younger brother. And he came back, and he couldn't get disturbed. It was in a growth plane in his wrist. And they took, and, but he's a younger brother. He comes home, and he has a cast, a weapon. And the plan feels a little more even now. And so they're beating the crap out of each other in about 2 minutes. And I couldn't allow it because Jesse was in jeopardy. So I got in Mike's face and I yelled. And he walked away from me and he walked into his room and he slammed the door. Slammed the door. So I got the dad kick going. I slammed the door. And I go to the door and I open the door. And before I can unload on him, he said, "Hold it a second. I didn't say you were wrong out there. You were right. But a big guy just got in my face and screamed and yelled. I didn't say you were wrong. Don't tell me I can't be mad." What's that? What is that? That's something he'd seen his mother and I try to do with varying degrees of success and failure. It's taking no crap and giving no crap. Stand up and tell somebody what you need without playing God with them, without telling them what to do. Took the time to live. That's a remarkable thing. And I learned it from my sons. I learned how to fight for my sons. I had nothing to bring to my marriage. I didn't know how to fight. I would either scream and tell my wife, quiet down, or I would cry until she quieted down. Either one is fine for me. I've always enjoyed the tyranny of helplessness. And I'm a loomer. I like to loom. I like to get a light behind me so I get her in the shadow. So I total eclipse of the Jew. So if I can work a scream, a cry, and a loom in one fight, that's a hat trick. Got it in a couple's workshop right there. And I learned how to fight for my sons. I felt so guilty about them being so injured. I used to pull them apart when they'd start fighting, and they'd start fighting again all the time. And my wife one day said to me, "You never let them finish." And I started sitting on my hands, letting them finish. And I started passing on to them the things I was receiving in sponsorship, which were sensible, consistent, and flexible limits. Sensible, consistent, flexible limits. When we drew close to him, he revealed himself to me, and that's how it got revealed to me. And I didn't know that I was plugging in more and more to the connective tissue in AA, and I felt it, but I didn't know that my alcoholism was starting to be buoyed above the horizon all the time. It's about a year sober I started sponsoring this guy. I sponsor him now. I sponsor him for 20 years. His name's Roland. And he used to call me every night and he'd leave a message on my answering machine. He says, "Scott, it's Roland. I'm sober. I love you. Good night." He'd hang up. And about 5 years after this, when Michael was about, he was 12 or something like that, I was about 6 years sober, and he came to me and said, "You know, Dad, I should tell you that when I was a little boy, I couldn't fall asleep until I heard Roland's voice on the tape. When I heard his voice, I knew it was okay, I could go to sleep. This is the kid I tried to rip God out of his life, and you guys came over the answering machine and tucked it in everything." Roland and Michael really adore one another. They have a really remarkable relationship. We didn't know what was happening when it was happening. And so we started making a beginning. I started learning how to fight, and I had a lot of crazy ideas. I thought in the back of my head that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. I didn't know how to make a contribution to my home. I didn't know how to act like a grown man. And I started washing dishes, and I started cleaning up a little bit. And I was about a year sober, and I had gotten an overture to be the staff director on a situation comedy. I was sponsored with some guys at that time. I was sort of becoming a spiritual Goliath, and I thought that if I got the as job director in the show, it would really be good for the guys I sponsor. They really, see the program at work. And I directed one episode, and I didn't get the job, and I almost drank. And I was humiliated. I went to my sponsor. I told him what had happened. And he said to me, well, I guess you have the show business guy. What? He said, well, what keeps you sober? I said, God. He said, okay, God keeps you sober, and you didn't get a show business job, and you almost drank. So I guess you have the show business God, and he has abandoned you utterly. When I came into AA, I heard people talking about God getting into relationships, God getting jobs, God getting parking spaces. And it scared me. It really did. Some years ago, our family was really injured in the Northridge earthquake. We got banged up pretty good. Our house got crashed up. And shortly after that, we were at an AA function out of town. And a woman walked up to me at this function and said, she used to live in L.A. And she said, oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, so he likes you. He likes you. We're crap, but he likes you. And she said to me, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn. I'm out of here. I can't possibly live in that world with a God saying, get him. Get the Redmond boy. Get him. Get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy. Get him. Get him. Curtis Microsoft, kill his goat, put a finger in his eye, again. Smote his ass, smote him, smote anyone he talks to, smote them all. I believe the big today, I believe St. Thomas, I believe the mystics, that to know God is to not know God. That no one can fully comprehend or define that power which is God, that God is mystery. And anytime anybody tries to anthropomorphize God, or ascribe an intention or personality, because I believe the word God is woefully inadequate in terms of what we're trying to express, they make God this big for me. The connective tissue of men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it's an incredible thing. When my son, a couple of years ago, he's 19, he's 28 now, he was babysitting for these people on the program, and the guy said to him, what do you think of your dad talking in AA? And I said, no, I'm happy for him, but I'm not a member. It's not a big deal for me. All I can tell you is since I'm a very, very little boy, the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon have taken very, very good care of me, and never once has any of them demanded that I believe what they believe. Wow. Wow. Especially in this time of so much spiritual propriety, of using spiritual tools and spiritual weapons, of all of this owning of God, to be in that kind of spiritual democracy, to be in a society with that much oxygen, that's incredible. That connective tissue of AA has kept my alcoholism moving above the horizon as a real piece of business for 21 years, even when I'm not looking at it. In the middle of the night, in between breaths, it's the face and the breath of God for me. And if I could just blow on the embers of that, if I could just encourage that a little bit, oh my God, what an honor, what an opportunity, what an incredible thing to see a guy push his seat back in the table and go, wow, I didn't know that's what it was. It's moral psychology. I didn't know self-examination with a moral application. I got a way to really actually act like a good guy. That's uncanny. I've never been able to do that. Extraordinary. And I know that that woman, that her God is keeping her sober, it just wouldn't be reasonable for me. My God expects me to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous if my kids are having a great experience or they're being annihilated. My God expects me to do my job if I'm living in a refrigerator box or the house up the hill. My God's just not handing out. He's not into real estate. That's just not the function of my spiritual life. Our sons are 28 and 25, just started a five-year fellowship at Stanford in mathematics, and Mike has got a ride at Cornell studying public policy, and I don't believe that it's because God likes us more than the people whose children are being annihilated. I can't imagine what it would be like to live in that world. It's like God is some deranged game show host, you know? Well, it's boils for you, you're due for a rash, you know, and you'll figure it out. There's a I had to write a resentment against that company for not giving me the job, and I had to write a resentment against myself for almost drinking. And when I did 67, after I read the inventory of my sponsor, he said, you know what, you're going to have to figure out, you're going to have to talk to your pop and find a way that you can stay sober through this. And when I did 67, which for me is the fire-starting moment, for me, it is quite often the most intimate experience that I have. I said, Pop, I've got to take the show business. Take it. I'll do anything for a living. I'm willing to do anything. Just keep me sober. And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God, and I said, I did not mean this. We had a grotesque misunderstanding. This wasn't even on the long list. I don't know what the hell it came up with. Now, in LA, when they make a movie or a TV show, they hire a caterer, you follow the cast and crew around, you make a lot of dough. It's Teamster dough. There are a lot of people on a movie set. But I'm Scott Ryan. And the first movie that I catered, the executive producer and star of the movie was a guy who I had worked with as a director. And he walked, he stuck his head on the truck and he said, can I have a burrito? Scott? What's happening, man? Is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. And I called my sponsor at the end of the day, and I said, oh, man, we're getting the gift now. And he said, sounds like you've got a resentment. And man, I worked the 10 steps. I wrote inventory and read it to him. I wound up serving people who had been my assistant directors and stage managers on shows I had directed. I wound up serving people who I had directed at shows. And I'd come back to my home group every night with a new tale of humiliation. And the guys would just go, ha, 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 ha. And I worked that 10 step, and I showed up and gave the dimes and a nickel, and I learned how to be a good cook. And my son Jesse asked me to teach him how to cook, and he and I have been cooking together ever since. I thought we'd get close on Oscar bumping night, you know, the night that we bumped the award. And we wound up having this extraordinarily intimate experience cooking together, and we still do it. He's been out of town at school, and he calls me, and I talk him through sauces, and it's just one of the great things that we do. Wouldn't have been the way that I did. And I cooked for 3 years and did a really good job. And at the end of 3 years, I had an overture made to me by a company called Ketchum Public Relations, this big time comedy writing job. And you know what? I'm sure that it would have been good for my sponsors. But you know what? This is really, and the reason why, okay, is because they've seen me suffer and now they'll see me prosper thusly, and it's going to be fantastic for them. And I had to do a videotape for my kid, and before I even heard about the job, my brain blew up. I crashed and burned. I wrote the inventory. One of the most awful defects of character for me in sobriety and out has been mind reading. It's been pointed out to me by someone I love that you're not a mind reader, you're barely a mind user. But I think I know what people are thinking, and they're never thinking anything good. They always think I'm a hose bag or something, but they're never really thinking anything particularly good. And my mind reading skills were terrible about that, about whether or not I was going to get the job. So I did the inventory, I released it. About a week later, I get a call from Ketchum that I did not get the job. And I'm good. And then I get a call to go up to Lake Arrowhead and cater some commercials, and I get the truck up there, and I grab the call sheet when I get there, which is a sheet that gives you all the information about it. And I see that the commercials are for Ketchum Public Relations. So I'm feeding them now. And I look at the truck, and the guy's videotaping me. So what are you doing? Said, we're taping the name of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. I'm going to go back to New York and show these guys the tape. And they're going to go, is that Scott Redman with that meatloaf? Oh my God. So I get up work, I call my sponsor, and I said, oh, we're getting a gift now. And then he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum, and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do.
Time of your life.